I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another weekly stream. My first guest today is Thomas Steuben. He writes for Countercurrents. He's been on the stream before. Thomas, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here, Greg.
And we are also joined by Gadius Maximus. Gadius, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going, Greg? How's it going, Thomas? Good to be here with you.
It's going well. I am riveted to the social media sphere because Donald Trump, caps locked and loaded, is going to war. If you look at his Gab stream, I've been looking at the Gab. I assume it's just mirroring what's on Truth Social or whatever they call that. It's all caps, and he's angry, and he's going to war. He has been indicted. He's been indicted by a Soros prosecutor in New York. Apparently, this guy has made a career of taking Black criminals and other criminals of color and taking felonies and turning them magically into misdemeanors or less. And now he's taken a misdemeanor, or what appears to be a misdemeanor, if it's even real, and he has gotten an indictment of the 45th president of the United States. And he ran, this is a Black DA backed by George Soros, ran on a platform of getting Trump, of indicting Trump. This is obvious election interference. And it is, I think, propaganda gold for us. And I just want to talk about the political benefits of this and some of the facts of the case. So first of all, I guess the claim is that Trump somehow paid hush money to this porn star who he may or may not have had sex with. Let's just assume that he did. Some hush money to keep her quiet. I'm wondering, is there any difference between being a criminal paying hush money to somebody, a bribe, and a victim of a criminal who's a shakedown artist or a blackmailer? Is there any actual difference between the two, except how it's framed by a prosecutor who's got an axe to grind? Thomas, what are your thoughts on this?
Not really, because I think a common theme that's emerging with current events in general is that this is never about justice. It's never about the rules. It's all only and basically only about power. And Spengler actually predicted this. I mean, he said, like, when a culture declines, civilization declines, the more people talk and yap about ideas, justice, the rule of law, whatever buzzword there is, whatever party thing there is, or our democracy, rules-based order, the less and less there's any idea. It's just simple power. It's what he would call zoological ups and downs, which is a fancy way of saying dog eat dog. So no, there's no difference, except for is a person involved a Democrat or a Republican at this point.
I'm stoked about it. I'm glad to see it happen at the same time. I mean, it's something you roll your eyes at because, I mean, we've known it's been coming for the past week, and it's obviously over something that's not even an issue. I'm not even sure what the crime would be. I mean, there's the old FBI adage that you could have a ham sandwich. You could indict a ham sandwich by noon on any given day or whatever. But I'm stoked about it because, I mean, like you said, he ran on getting Trump, and so did the state's attorney or whatever in New York. Like, pretty much every politician in New York runs on going after Trump, taking him out or whatever. And it really just increases the polarization, draws the battle lines even clearer, and it shows people that there's a distinction. There's like two political nations forming in the same country, and it's like one side's playing to win and the other side's not really doing anything about it right now. So it's like the right is going to have to get itself in gear or they're just going to get rolled over. So I'm happy about it. I like the spectacle value of it. Obviously, Trump getting indicted, the left is going to dance the jig over it. And some people on the right or whatever, the conservatives, are going to point and sputter about it. But it also just, like I said, it just deepens the, like, draws the battle lines clearer. And it shows everyone that, you know, it really is just a power game, like Thomas said.
I think that this is propaganda gold for us for a number of reasons. And it might actually be very good for us politically. As trust in the system declines, populism rises. Therefore, if the system wants to beat back populism, they need to restore trust. However, because we are ruled by immature, foolish people who can't help themselves, including this DA, and apparently nobody wiser tried to talk him out of this because they're all in a tizzy about the fascist Trump and everything is justified to get the fascist Trump. Because that there are no wise elders of the Democratic Party to talk people out of this kind of stuff, they're making a serious mistake. They are just destroying their credibility even more. And that undermines not just the Democratic Party, it also undermines the Republican Party because they're part of the establishment. They're basically married to one another. Republicans and Democrats, they're married. It's a pathological, dysfunctional marriage where the Republicans are the abused spouses that cling to the Democrats. But if they're still married, they're joined at the hip. And they're fates are joined as well. And by doing this, the Democrats and the Republicans who will go along with it are leading to the decline of their own power. So this is a good thing. We can point at this for years and years to come and show that this is just a cynical game at this point. And that's useful for us. It's bad for them. In the long run, as trust in the system declines, our fortunes will get better. So that is a good thing. Another thing is that it's just damn good entertainment, I have to say. Trump is a highly entertaining figure. That's part of his appeal. He's caps locked and flailing away. And interestingly enough, even Republicans who don't like him are now feeling more sympathetic toward him. We're seeing people coalescing around Trump because they see that this is obvious put up, that this is election interference. This is banana Republicanism, just like the stolen election in 2020. More banana Republicanism. We don't like that in America. We like to think of ourselves as a free people. And as that declines and it becomes increasingly obvious that no, we're really ruled by an evil establishment and they always get what they want and the people don't get what they want. We call that liberal democracy, by the way. The foundation is laid for an alternative, and we represent that alternative even better than Donald Trump. So Trump is taking a beating, and they might put him in jail. They might make it impossible for him to run for president. It's an injustice. It's a flagrant injustice, and it might be a good thing for the fortunes of populism. It might actually be a better thing for populism than if Trump actually got the revenge tour and got elected president for a third time and actually ended up taking office for a second time, because we've seen that he's kind of ineffectual in office. So if Trump is martyred, basically, and taken out of the game by blatant corruption and political partisanship, I think that is going to create more opportunity for a populist nationalist shift in the future. And that's good for us. And I pity Trump. I think Trump is being victimized here. This is obviously unjust. But he might be more useful to populism as a martyr than as an actual sitting president at this point. So I have to be a little bit cold and calculating about that. And even if they take him out of politics entirely, they think that that is their ultimate victory. I think it's not a win for them. I think that that hastens the day that we'll get a real populist sweeping into power. And then they're going to regret not having Trump around. There was a guy that I used to know on Facebook. He went under the pen name Raiden. I lost track of that guy. If you're out there, send me an email at editor@countercurrents.com. But he said something really wise during the Trump campaign. He said, Trump isn't the last hope for white America. He's the last hope for the system. Meaning he's the last hope that the system can somehow maintain a multiracial, civic nationalist society on solid political grounds, solid economic and political grounds. He's their last hope. He's not our last hope. And by attacking Trump, these people are actually attacking the last hope of trying to make America as a multicultural project work. And that's also a good thing. We want that project to fail. And this is why I've said that the worst possible thing for white nationalists would be a Trump dictatorship, where you had multiracial civic nationalism imposed by a strongman. What you'd have is something like Putin's Russia, which is far worse for the ethnic interests of the Russian people than a sort of chaotic liberal democracy with a multicultural ideology. Because at least in a chaotic liberal democracy, we can advocate for our own ethnic interests, where if you put full state power behind sort of a conservative branded multiculturalism, that's a death sentence for us.
Yeah, I think, I think you should just enjoy the show. Like, I'm still marginally Trump supporter or whatever, but I'm not invested in it, like, emotionally or anything. It's, I mean, the glory days of 2016 will never return. I think we're seeing that with recent events, but yeah, just enjoy the ride, enjoy the spectacle, and don't be invested in it, and just let it play out. And, you know, it'll be punished Trump, you know, punished Trump will come out swinging, or he'll fold up, and that'll be that. So,
I feel for the guy. Honestly, this is making me like him more. And if he's as feisty as he is now all the way through, this is going to be good. I hope he doesn't fold, right? He doesn't look at accountants' reports and listen to a bunch of, you know, bean counters and number crunchers and lawyers and suddenly do an about face on this. I hope he really goes down swinging, because that would do him credit. And it would be energizing for the populist right in America. Every time we hear some new outrage about Trump, it's like, okay, this is the system that opposes us, right?
Well, the backlash has gotten to where even his chief competitor, Ron DeSantis, he put out that statement saying, you know, Florida isn't going to comply with New York City or whatever, because Alvin Bragg is a Soros-backed DA, and the media, every time any Republican mentions George Soros, they say it's a dog whistle for anti-Semitism. But even Ron DeSantis, I mean, he sort of had to bend the knee a little bit and say, no, I'm not going to comply. I'm not going to let you bully, you know, one of my citizens or whatever. So if Ron DeSantis, his chief competitor, is acting that way, it's just the base itself is going to go nuts. And we've already seen, you know, a little bit of protest forming. Apparently Marjorie Taylor Greene is supposed to go to New York City next week and kick up a fuss. So we'll see where all this goes. I mean, I don't think it's going to get to January 6th proportions ever again, but I do think, you know, there's still something there in the populist right enough for a little bit of a show.
Yeah. So I want to talk about this act by our friend DeSantis in Florida. First of all, I don't see any sign that Trump has acknowledged this act of solidarity in a gracious way. He just keeps ranting about Ron DeSanctimonious and how he owes him everything. It's really unattractive. The narcissism of this guy is just unhinged. However, Thomas, maybe you can throw some light on this. We've heard this term nullification, right? The states nullifying. Well, this isn't a state nullifying a federal decree, okay? But this is one state saying that we are not going to comply with an extradition from another state. Is that even constitutional?
Here's the ultimate red pill on constitutional law. Whatever, it's constitutional, whatever you can get away with. As Andrew Jackson said famously, the court has their order, let it be enforced. Now, the law school answer, I'm not too sure about. I do know the 10th Amendment says that the rights of the states are reserved to the states. The rebuttal to that is that, well, the states don't have the right to not cooperate. There is a full faith and credit clause of the Constitution, which generally means that states can't discriminate. So if, you know, state A indicts a person, well, state B has to cooperate with them, just like it's the same state. While this comes up with like child and custody orders and all that. However, does a state have to follow something that's unconstitutional? Well, what's unconstitutional? A lot of people, when it's simply unfair, say it's unconstitutional. A lot of people, like a dog, will destroy the tulip bed, and then the city won't do anything. And the poor citizen will cry about how their right to property has been infringed because the city's inaction. No, this is just a tulip bed. It's not a takings under the Commerce Clause. However, this comes down to a thing where it is kind of like, I think it is unconstitutional. I think there are bigger things here. And I would say that this is what Carl Schmitt calls the state of exception. And, you know, sanctimonious DeSantis can decide there's an exception. Maybe not the exception where it's a full recession of law, the state remaining, but yes, the law, the usual law and way of doing things can recede and Florida can remain. And all this comes down to is this, where in the Constitution does it say that a state has to follow the other states no matter what? And this is all made up. And a lot of this would come down to case law and what cases have said this. But then cases get overturned all the time. So when you really think about it, constitutional law is not what is. We pretend like it is for the sake of bar exam, the law school exams. It's always in a state of becoming. It's never in a state of being, because the Supreme Court can change it. For so example, right now, everyone could say, no, Ron, it's clearly being unconstitutional. But what if, you know, this explodes and it becomes a court case and it winds up on the Supreme Court docket? Then the Supreme Court says, well, actually, good old DeSantis was right. Well, actually, he was constitutional then. The law changed. And so, Right. Yes, this is all made up as we make it. And I think, too, talking about nullification, I like to talk very briefly about another type of nullification, my favorite type, which is jury nullification. And that's when a juror says, well, even if I'm being instructed to, under the law, to find this person guilty or liable, if it's a civil suit for something, say, negligence, I don't think the law should apply here. I don't think it's just. Judges hate this. They absolutely despise it. And this is the final check of the people against the judiciary, where they're sovereign and not the court, not a critarchy of judges. And I know you said earlier that this wasn't just what's happening to Trump, but it kind of is. There's a little bit of schadenfreude because Trump kind of abandoned the Rise Above movement and many other nationalists who have been viciously persecuted. And just a few days ago, a week before Easter, what the coincidence, the great American patriot and defender of MAGA grannies from savage Antifa terrorists, Rob Rondeau, was arrested in Romania and extradited to America for this kangaroo trial over in LA. Given the absolute insanity of transgender nonsense that's going on right now, that's pretty disgusting, and with Trump being viciously persecuted, I think it increases the likelihood that a juror will go rogue and acquit Rise Above movement, Rob Rondeau, and there's three other individuals. So ironically, Trump probably has done more to help these guys, these ardent nationalists, by being arrested than during his whole term of office, because now there's this ongoing problem where jurors, they tend to be weaklings. They simply are not paid enough. And I forgot who it was in Plato's Republic who said that money made it easier for him to be just. I think it was someone who had a name like Syphilis. I don't know how to pronounce it. That guy.
Yeah.
Well, you're expecting these jurors to like basically be enslaved. They're paid a few pennies and they have to miss work and the work probably doesn't cover it, or only partially. So they want to get out of there. It becomes a contest of wills. And because liberals are more radical, for all their issues, they do ardently believe in what they believe in. And I'll be honest with you, they just aren't as employed as we are, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they will oftentimes be the ones who stick to their guns, while the conservatives were like, well, the rule of law, or I want to go home. This is what happened in Charlottesville. They purposely timed the Charlottesville trial to be right before Thanksgiving so that all these silly people could go home, would have pressure to go home for their holiday and screw over other Americans so they could stuff their face with turkey.
Right.
Very bourgeois.
Yeah, yeah.
But this might give some fire to these jurors to go rogue and say, no, Ram are heroes, and you know, I don't like you, so I'm just going to go rogue.
Yeah, well, I would love to see that in the Trump jury, too. If this goes to a jury trial, it would be great if the jury would nullify this. I think that we're getting to a point where that's going to happen. And again, if certain states are just going to say, I'm sorry, we're not going to go along with New York City's vendetta against Donald Trump, That's laying the groundwork for the national divorce idea, the red states and the blue states going their separate ways. We, of course, don't think that that's exactly the breakdown that should be happening. Obviously, we would like white people and other peoples to be going their separate ways. But if a national divorce did happen in America, that would definitely disempower the left considerably. It would basically, there'd be states who are saying, I'm sorry, we're not going to go along with this kind of lawless leftism. And that's really what's going on here. It might be the letter of the law, but it's obviously not the spirit of the law. This is lawlessness. This is banana republicanism. And people get, again, really, really excited about this. They feel like their free government is being taken away from them. Their votes are being nullified, et cetera. And they don't like that. So I'm hopeful that this is going to cause the pot to boil over in the coming months. Anything that increases polarization is good for populists, I think. We just always need to try and reformat or rephrase, regestalt the real lines of division here. And try and get this away from partisan Democrat and partisan Republican to, if we could just talk about whites and anti-whites, that would be really good. Folks, if you have questions for me or Gadius or Thomas, send a super chat. That's the way to get noticed first. So if you'd like to do that, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. We're not streaming there, but we are taking donations there. Hit the green button. You can leave a comment and a question as well as your super chat, and it's very helpful. Entropy is the only group that stuck with us when we were deplatformed completely from the global credit card processing industry a few years ago. They stuck with us, and they really deserve a lot of praise for being free speech absolutists, the stalwarts. And so I always like to plug them first. You can send Cash App donations now to Countercurrents. You can also send, I can't send DLive tokens today for some reason, but you can send Odyssey tips as well. And we very much appreciate that. So guys, is there anything more to say about the Trump indictment?
Point is that the Seventh Amendment was made. The reason why that is such an enumerated right, a right to jury trial, was because we had this issue in the colonies where colonists were being hauled before foreign magistrates or foreign courts, not tried by jury of their peers. And I feel like that's happening right now. I think right now that, say, all these American patriots from January 6th who get hauled to Washington, D.C. before a system judge or a regime jury, it's even more foreign now than Britain was to the colonies. At least the British and the colonies had some type of ethnic thing. Frankly, even though a lot of these jurors and judges are technically white, they're so deracinated and strange that they aren't really our race. Even the ones who are white are not like fellow whites or Indians. So really, I think this really is a strong talking point for the national divorce, because we're such a foreign country. We're being hauled before foreign courts that are extremely hostile towards us and hostile jurors. Mm-hmm. This means that prosecutors know this. They can go hog wild. They don't have to worry. Oh, yeah.
I saw
everybody knows that Trump can't get a fair trial in New York. That's just obvious. Yeah, go ahead, Gadius.
The Colin Flaherty had this term. He used to talk about black juries acquitting obviously black criminals. He called them Bronx juries, I believe. And we've seen that more and more over the past few years with, you know, the BLM and all that stuff. The McMichaelses, even if the juries aren't black, they're intimidated by the regime. And it's just getting to a point to where, you know, everyone's pretty much getting blackpilled on, you know, juries. I mean, we've just seen, you know, yesterday the verdict in the Ricky Vaughn trial. But it's like, I agree with you, Thomas, about jury nullification and the power of it. But when it's like you said, when people are so different from each other to where you could have, you know, hey, we're gonna snatch this guy from Florida and take him to New York to stand trial. It's like you're taking him to a different country, basically. I saw something. I think it was Charlie Kirk yesterday. He said, "Well, if they're gonna try Trump in New York, we're gonna try Bill Clinton in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho." And it's like, Bill Clinton, dude, nobody cares about Bill Clinton. Not even like the left or the Democrats care about Bill Clinton anymore. So it's like, if you want to fight fire with fire on that front, you gotta come with something a little more aggressive than that.
How about try Hunter Biden in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, we can get him under oath and find out who the big guy was who got the 10%.
I think that's what Thomas was getting at too, with, you know, basically it's becoming like a foreign country. When you go to some of these jurisdictions, it's like it's a kangaroo court, and a lot of people are just getting blackpilled on like all the institutions, every single institution, the district attorney, the judges, even the jurors, you know. So I think it's a good thing too. It leads to more polarization and sharper battle lines.
Go ahead.
Another quick point, if I can tack it on, is that I was reading this book called The American Regime by Antelope Hill. We don't know who wrote it yet. It's by an anonymous January 6th defendant. We had a really good article talking about how the judiciary and the legal profession are unusually intertwined with the cathedral. Because basically the cathedral, that's Mencius Moldbug / Curtis Yarvin's theory about how the media and academia are intertwined to basically use soft power to manipulate stuff. But the judiciary, because law requires 3 additional years, it's unusually intertwined. And two, due to how constitutional case law is built, all these cases, they don't just come out thin air. Usually they're backed up by an amicus curiae brief, by something like that. And therefore, these academics are able to, from their ivory towers, are able to manipulate case law with law review articles and such, much more than any other field where professors might touch upon it. So I think the judiciary, besides, of course, the fact that certain people are overrepresented in the legal profession, the mere fact that this is how it works, it means that it was always kind of at risk of becoming like this. It needs to become more controlled by the people and less by academics and scholars and judges.
Yeah, that's really true. The next thing I want to talk about is the Ricky Vaughn conviction. Douglas Mackey went under the name Ricky Vaughn. He was a Twitter personality in the glory days of the online alt-right. I remember the troll, the text your vote to Hillary thing with the black women on in the meme. I shared it on social media. Thank goodness that all those accounts have been taken down now. So I guess I can't be accused of being part of some kind of racketeering or conspiracy to liking a meme or something. Maybe RICO is coming for me. Maybe I should just shut up about this. But
Alvin Bragg's on the case.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, I remember the meme. I thought it was hilarious. Apparently what happened is if you actually texted your vote, you would get some little message back saying that this was not officially endorsed by the Hillary Clinton campaign. But of course, that's kind of mealy-mouthed. And it's not, if he had just said, ha ha, you've been pranked, he might have been able to escape by saying that this was a prank. But some people, and I guess there are objective records, some people were stupid enough to think that they could vote by text. I imagine that many of them voted for Hillary. Some of them might have voted for Trump, which is even more hilarious. However, I think this comes under free speech and satire. There was a similar meme that was floated trying to get Trump supporters to vote by text, although it didn't apparently include a phone number. So anyway, this memer is indicted right after the stolen election. I guess right at the beginning of 2021 or the end of 2020. And this has finally gone to trial, and a jury of his peers, whatever that means, has convicted him of election interference. I think this cannot stand. I think that This is an obvious attempt to chill freedom of speech. It's an obvious attempt to take down a particularly talented internet troll, Twitter troll, who was very, very effective at basically handing liberals their asses, maybe for the first time in their lives. This is why they went all out for censorship. They thought that they believed in freedom of speech when they were the only voices in the room. And when they actually started encountering people who talked back to them and made fun of them and humiliated them in argument, they turned on a dime and tried to shut these people down. And you know very well that Ricky Vaughn really stuck in the cross of a lot of these people. And I'm sure there was a little cabal that decided, yeah, we need to make an example of this guy. I think this is clearly an assault on freedom of speech. There's plenty of stuff that's accepted in political campaigning that is under the guise of freedom of speech, but you know, it's lying, right? These people lie all the time. He's going to take away your Social Security. No, probably not. You don't really believe that. It's a lie. He's going to cause nuclear war. No, probably not. That's a lie. But making fun of Black women, because that's the face on this meme, and they're sacred after all, making fun of Black women and maybe costing a few votes to Hillary Clinton, not enough to have changed the outcome of the election, mind you. We were told that we should ignore the massive election fraud that took place in 2020. But this guy needs to be convicted for a prank in 2016. That's fascinating, right? And weren't all the establishment people saying maybe there was a little bit of fraud, but it couldn't have changed the outcome of the election, right? That was their argument to basically move along, folks. There's nothing to see here. Obviously, this could not have changed the outcome of the election. So shouldn't we just move along, folks, and nothing to see here? Obviously, no, there's a different standard here. But, you know, pointing out double standards with leftists is like shooting fish in a barrel. What are your thoughts on this, Gaddius?
I wasn't around, so to speak, for the optics war. So I'm not really up to speed on like the lore behind, you know, the movement, the goings on and everything. And, you know, I got a rule, like I don't seethe in public, like, you know, whoever seethes first loses, you know, that's like one of the unwritten rules of online banter or whatever. But if there's something that could make me seethe, something, it's stuff like this. It's the blatant targeting of somebody for what they say online. That's like one of my number one core issues is free speech. Because, I mean, if we don't have that, we really don't have anything. That's like our strongest weapon right now. And it something tells me that's the reason he was, you know, indicted or whatever and put on trial and found guilty. It was because of this, to send a message to chill free speech online. So, yeah, this is the type of thing that would make me see that. I don't like it at all. And I think everybody, no matter what, should be totally against. I've seen a couple things over the past 24 hours that I was actually sort of surprised at. You know, people on this side of things dunking on the guy. Haha, you got what you deserved because of some drama that happened 5 years ago or whatever. Some sort of beef. And it's like, you know, guys, have we really lost the plot here? Like, there's some things that's more important than, you know, like beef, online beef or whatever, or drama. And it's like, this guy's being hung out to dry. I don't even care who he is. Like, take him out of the picture. Just put in like generic right-wing person, and they're getting railroaded over something they said online for posting memes.
We're getting railroaded over memes. And now that the memer has been railroaded, are they going to extend conspiracy laws to encompass everybody who shared the meme or liked the meme? This is how insidious it is. If the purpose of this is to chill free speech online, that's exactly what they're going to do. Thomas, do you have any thoughts on this? Have you been following the Ricky Vaughn conviction?
Yes, I do. And the whole thing, it really comes down to is how mass democracy inevitably is idiocracy. And the way this plays out legally is that the right to vote should be considered a group right, the nation's right to have a fair election. But it's always cast as an individual right, which is stupid because your individual vote counts for absolutely nothing. It doesn't matter if some dumb doesn't get to vote. Like you said, it cannot change the election. However, they always cast it as this huge thing about my civil rights, the Civil War, blah, blah, blah. It's this, I think the Department of Justice's thing said, like, a jury of his peers and the sacred right, whatever. This shouldn't be an individual right. It's a group right. And this Talmudic understanding of the right to vote has completely destroyed election laws. For example, we can't have voter ID because of a case, and I forget the case name because it's pretty frivolous. It's all made up anyways, but what happens that there is some disabled, poor, old, elderly lady who couldn't go to the DMV to get a driver's license or an alternate form of, you know, we can get alternate forms of state ID. And they were talking about, like, can we, you know, the dissent was talking, well, could you just get her a bus pass? Can we just bend over backward and give her, like, programs, get her butt to the DMV office, wherever, to get her state ID? And just the record, we have to get IDs to buy alcohol, see certain types of movies. But no, because this, you know, basket case person exists, one person might be slightly inconvenienced. You know, apparently she can't get a neighbor to take her or call, like, some, like, all because of a 0.001% of the population might be inconvenienced for, so they can't, allegedly can't vote. When, you know, we had, you know, supposedly in World War II and other wars, young men dying to on the you know, fields of Normandy for the right to vote, even though that's totally not accurate. I won't go down into my World War II rant, but that's what we were told. Well, because of that, we can't have nice things. It's an individual right, not a group right. And therefore, we can't have nice things because there are stupid people. And yeah, in democracy, you have very stupid people. So now what this leads to is that we can't make memes or talk because some literal retard might actually believe this. And this would have no bearing upon the election. You know what? We used to have literacy tests in this country. I personally think no one who isn't, you know, we didn't have higher standards. I don't think we can go back to, like, just land of white males only voted, but I think there are other options such as military service, as in Starship Troopers.
Oh,
literacy,
yes,
tests, physical tests. But no, I think if you were dumb enough to fall for this, you just shouldn't vote because you're too dumb. But no, this is a sacred right in our democracy.
Yeah. Because this has turned into the case of the one person and her precious rights being trampled by the fact that she's old or lazy or whatever. All of us have to have our votes basically bastardized and nullified by insecure elections. Yeah, it's a completely ridiculous, you know, fake moral drama. And I completely agree with that. My view was that if somebody is dumb enough to fall for this, that they shouldn't be voting anyway. And, you know, all of life's an IQ test, and some people lost. So I think that we should do, though, is we should definitely be up in arms about this, because this is obviously an attempt to destroy freedom of speech. It's an attempt to destroy memes. It's an attempt to destroy the extremely effective online asymmetrical warfare that dissident alt-right types used against the establishment in 2015, 2016. It's an attempt to destroy.
It's our number one weapon. Free speech is our number one weapon, and we can't just, like I said, like, I saw Richard Spencer, like, dancing, you know,
don't mention him, because he's just not.
Not
to be taken seriously. But I know what you're saying. I don't even know what his beef is, except he's just completely motivated by bitterness over the fact that he's not the emperor of the universe by this point.
Yeah, but, he's doing the ex-girlfriend thing. But
yeah,
it's
you're our right, crazy man. Ex-girlfriend, Richard Spencer. But yes, I saw Spencer's little thumbsy uppy thing. I saw Jason Kessler ranting about this. And let's switch to this. I think, okay, I remember when Nick Fuentes got booted from Twitter some time ago, people asked me what I thought about it. And I said, well, look, there are many things that I don't like about Nick Fuentes, many things that I don't agree with Nick Fuentes about. But let's be real here. Nick Fuentes was not being booted off Twitter for the things that I quibble with. He was being booted off Twitter because of the good things that he was saying, for the most part. And, you know, we should have solidarity, absolute solidarity with any victim of persecution, unless there's some kind of moral hazard implied, you know, where people are doing incredibly stupid things and we're supposed to rush to their aid. But this isn't the case. He was exercising his free speech rights and he was booted. And I say absolute solidarity with that, even though I don't like the things he says. Now, I think that that should be the attitude of all these people, except for mean, bitter ex-girlfriends, crazy ex-girlfriends like Richard Spencer, who can't do that. We should all be 100% in solidarity for this victim of persecution for exercising his right to make memes, okay? And let's dig into this, though. Why is there so much bitterness towards Ricky Vaughn? Well, the answer is basically this. And it has to do with Charlottesville and the aftermath of Charlottesville. Jason Kessler, in this very angry Telegram post, was talking about how Ricky Vaughn and his friends divided the white nationalist movement with the optics war. Okay, I was there, I saw that, and I was on Ricky Vaughn's side. And let me explain why. Because I think this is very, very important. I've flogged this little Sun Tzu type aphorism for years now, that the essence of a bad strategy is to attack your enemy's strengths from a position of weakness, whereas the essence of a good strategy is to attack your enemy's weaknesses from a position of strength. Now, there are two ways of attacking our enemies here. One is through street activism, and the other, and protests and things like that. And the other is through propaganda. We cannot control the streets in our society. And we've seen what happens when we try and do peaceful protests and things like that. It's wrong. We can't control streets. We can't exercise our right to gather and protest. And when we tried that at Charlottesville, there was this conspiracy against that led to many people being injured, people being enmeshed in lawfare and ridiculous conspiracy charges that have only recently finally, you know, had a verdict. And then, of course, people are still having to deal with the damage awards and stuff like that. So it's gone on for years. My heart goes out to those people. They're victims of the system. However, after Charlottesville, even Countercurrents got deplatformed. We got attacked after Charlottesville. Even though I was a skeptic about it, even though I wasn't there, I interviewed some of the people in the run-up to the Unite the Right, asked them some questions about it. I talked to Augustus Invictus, and I said, well, it's great to have a lawyer like you involved in this so everybody can be informed about what their rights are and how that they should behave if they have an encounter with the police. And he just said, well, actually, no, it hadn't occurred to us to. And I just thought, oh, my God. I just thought, oh, my God. What I did, as soon as I got off the phone with him, I think it was a Skype chat or something, I contacted a few friends that I knew were going to be there. And I said, I think you should stay away from this. I don't think this has been wisely planned. And I think you're walking into a trap. So
I think the week prior, you go back in the Countercurrents archives, the podcast archives, I think you were the week prior, you were saying you had a bad feeling about it. I'm pretty sure.
That was why I had a bad feeling about it, because I talked to one of the organizers, which was Augustus Invictus. I was told to talk to him. I can't remember if it was Kessler or not, but Invictus was involved in it on some level organizing it. And so anyway, I had a bad feeling about it. And I shared that with friends and I said, don't go. And some of them didn't go. And I'm glad they didn't go because they dodged a bullet. But anyway, because of poorly planned and poorly thought out street activism, where a fat woman died in a car accident. The whole establishment had a moral panic, a frenzy, and the deplatforming hit people like me. It hit platforms like the Daily Stormer even worse, because they were actually tweeting mean things about the poor dead Heather Heyer, etc. They were almost wiped off the web. And it forced a moment of reflection here. And it's like, these people with their retard rallies and goon marches, as people started calling them, these Wignats, which is a term that combines white nationalist with Wigger, and the meaning of it is a white nationalist who acts basically impulsive and foolish, like a Black person, like a stereotypical Black. That was coined by Ricky Vaughn. And that was applied in the aftermath of Charlottesville. And it was an attempt to divide the movement, but there was a division that needed to be made. We needed to have it out. We needed to have a debate about, given how vulnerable we all are to deplatforming, why should the things that are actually doing, making progress, namely the online propaganda, why is that being shut down because of people who were too eager to take it to the streets in poorly planned street rallies with bad optics? It wasn't just optics, it was also planning. Why should we be threatened by this? This is bad. We were allowing the people who had the bad strategic idea of challenging the state in the streets, threatening the people who had the better strategic idea, the more effective strategic idea of online propaganda, where we were actually winning victories. Why should these people endanger us? And isn't it a moral hazard if we stand by out of solidarity and not air this out? Now, I understand there's still a huge amount of bitterness over this because a lot of people's feelings were hurt. But damn it, I think it was a necessary debate to have. And I think that the online propaganda faction won, and that there has been a retrenching of our efforts because we have limited resources. After we managed to fight our way back from some of the deplatforming, people focused on, you know, less street activism and more online propaganda, where we were actually making progress. And I think it was a successful and necessary debate to have. But people like Fuentes, well, Fuentes was there, but then he immediately started using Wignat against people. People don't like Fuentes, and people like Jason Kessler, Brad Griffin, they were all very hurt by the Wignat slur. And they still despise Ricky Vaughn. They still despise Fuentes for using it. And I just think that at this point, they need to get over that, because frankly, Ricky Vaughn deserves a bit of sympathy and solidarity from all of us, because he's being attacked for memeing. And if he can be attacked for memeing, if he can be jailed for memeing, then all of us are vulnerable. So those are my thoughts on it. I think he was right on that issue, on the Wignat versus the online propaganda struggle. And frankly, I'm glad that we have less Wignattery going on, because every time Richard Spencer got out in public and with a microphone in his hand, bad things were happening to the movement. And I'm glad he's basically retreated to Twitter and is just sort of sniping at people from his little rat hole on Twitter now, where he can do almost no harm if anybody pays attention to him. So those are my thoughts. Thomas, you've been silent on this. I mean, yeah. What are your thoughts on this case?
So
what should we do about it?
So when Charlottesville went down, I knew vaguely about the alt-right, because people were always complaining about it and saying, like, you sound like one of those crazy guys, crazy anti-Semites. I was like, well, whatever. I was focused on personal issues rather than politics at the time, though I was a Trump supporter. Charlottesville happened. I was like, wow, this is awesome, actually. I'm one of the few people who was actually enticed by Charlottesville instead of driven away. Just because it was like, wow, there's something new going on. But for me, for Charlottesville, for all these issues about narco-tyranny, I go by the Arab maxim of me against my brother, my brother and I against our cousin, my cousin and I against the world. So yes, I might have a beef with people. For example, I despise Fuentes. I think he's absolutely immoral, but like when he is legitimately persecuted by the state, I'll stand by him. And I think Ricky Vaughn is a lot better of a person than Fuentes by quite a large margin. So I'll stand by him 100%. Really, even the people who I despise, like even a certain whiskey enjoyer during the Charlottesville, you know, trial, I was rooting for him. I may not shake his hand. I may not ever be his friend. I want nothing to do with him. But, you know, when the state involves, we're all one tribe. And they see us all as one enemy. So we should probably, you know, I don't think we should be one army, but they can be an allied army. They can be next door. We can do our thing. I refuse, once the state gets involved, like, I refuse to get, you know, shoot back and forth. But two, I think going to optics and all that, I think a good contrast to draw is that optics isn't just about the method, it's about the presentation. For example, I do think that there does need to, you know, online versus in the street. I think online is a better way. And not everyone who was in the street had bad optics. For example, the what I would call polo shirt nationalism was also present, and that was tarnished by maybe people in Stahlhelms. But I think a return of polo shirt nationalism, IRL, is a thing. It shouldn't be in the streets. It should be at your college Republicans, Turning Point USA. These places should be used as places to network, subvert, and take over and meet like-minded people, even though they are technically controlled opposition. So, yeah, I'm 100% against Stahlhelms. I don't think street rallies are a thing. The only people who should be doing street rallies are probably Patriot Front. And they have a system in place to keep them safe, keep it legal. Even then, they sometimes have problems. So, but they understand that they're basically the crack troops, and there's a certain type of people for that. People who have a lot to lose or have a different personality are better off going towards Turning Point USA and subverting it and making it ours than being in the streets. And two, for me, optics has always been about, I think we really should have a return to polo shirt nationalism. No one's filling that gap right now. And, you know, maybe that will change in the future.
Yeah, I think this is important. There are some distinctions that need to be made when we talk about in the street stuff. First of all, I have always maintained, even though I was very critical of the way that the Charlottesville event went down, I was always willing to say, look, if you have a single group that's highly disciplined and has its messaging dialed in and tight, it's fine for them to do things like banner drops or protests or whatever. And I was thinking of the identitarians in Europe, and I'm thinking of groups like Identity Europa, polo shirt nationalism. And
just another quick point to make is that oftentimes when the polo shirt nationalists did their thing or GI in real life, it actually had more effects online. For example, they would put up posters, flyers, a banner. They'd then post it on Twitter to spread it. And so that way, I think, is more important. Instead of like focusing on the street or whatever, or the literal IRL, have it be used as kind of like a backdrop or a scene to create something aesthetic or artistic, then post that online. And if you look app, there's some controversy surrounding him, to say the least. I don't know what to make of him at this moment. I have some serious doubts. But he did perfect the strategy of taking revolutionary books to cool locations and situations, taking pictures of them and creating this mystique. And so the book, the IRL, there's no high stakes march, there's no shouting or whatever, no tiki torches, but the book was in real life. And it would always imply that we're out there, we're active people, we're meeting other people. You know, they'd have like random hot girls showing the book, showing that we're sociable people who can get random girls just to hold up this dissident book.
Right.
So yeah, I think, you know, IRL can be a thing, but you know, that always is more online. It was an online's a force multiplier.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a fact about the identitarians. A lot of their IRL events were not things where they announced their presence in advance to the press and the Antifa, and then allowed large groups of people to come and attack them. They would do these things quickly. They would record them and broadcast them on social media and leave before anybody could show up and have a physical confrontation. That was very effective. If the Charlottesville event consisted entirely of the Tiki Torch March the night before. And then these people basically left town before the mobs showed up the next day. It would have been a huge victory. They would have basically gotten out of town with almost no controversy and no confrontations. There's a little bit of confrontation at the march, but almost none, because they didn't announce they were doing that in advance. And so the enemy didn't have time to, come out and oppose them. If they had done something like that and then just left town, it would have been totally different in my opinion. So, but yeah, there's a distinction between IRL stuff that is highly photogenic, low risk, and uses the media as a force multiplier versus the IRL stuff where you don't have any control over the messaging. That's another thing about the Tiki Torch March. They had the look and the messaging all dialed in advance. They didn't have a bunch of different groups showing up with different flags and different messages and sort of photobombing one another's opportunities to get their message out. They didn't have that at all, and so it was cohesive. But when you invite a bunch of different groups, you're also inviting feds, you're inviting adjunct provocateurs, you're inviting the enemies to show up, and you're creating a situation where there's going to be conflict, and we can't win those battles. And we should never try to win those sorts of battles. We don't have the strength to do it, and we've seen people's lives ruined because of this, sadly. Now, another group that does IRL stuff, including protests, very well with a controlled message. It's not some motley Unite the Right kind of thing where you have different groups with competing interests, is Patriotic Alternative in Great Britain. I think that's a good model too.
Yeah.
So we do need to bring that up. The identitarians in continental Europe, Patriotic Alternative, they do have a good model. And if something like that were to spring up in America or return in the case of something like return with a V, like Identity Europa could return, that would be great. I would love to see that happen. That is, let's face it, it's IRL, but it's still mostly propaganda. And it's far lower risk and far higher potential reward than these marches. And there would be no Stahlhelms either. And that's why I think we needed to have that debate. And I think Ricky Vaughn nailed it with the Wignat slur. And he's gotten a lot of bitterness. But come on, folks. Again, his right to meme is our right to meme. And if they're gonna jail him for memeing, they're gonna come after every one of us who liked his memes. And guess what? I bet even Jason Kessler and Brad Griffin liked those memes, or at least shared them and got a laugh out of them. So this is a threat to us all. And Ricky Vaughn is our political prisoner. He's a political martyr. He's not being persecuted because of the bad things that he said that we might disagree with. He's being prosecuted and persecuted because of the good things that he did. And the good thing, the broadest good thing that he did, is use his free speech rights against the political establishment. And they will never forgive that. And we have to fight this war to preserve the First Amendment from butthurt shitlibs who've never forgiven 2015 and 2016.
Absolutely. That's the thing. The optics question is settled. It's not even up for debate anymore. We've had experiments run every weekend this entire year so far by Patriotic Alternative in the UK. Every weekend they've been out there with their signs and banners, giving speeches, dressed to the nines, looking good, peak optics, right?
Yeah.
No crazy stuff. They're out there doing that because that's basically their strong point. That's sort of what they have to do. There's sort of like this inversion going on. Like Americans, we're not really out in the street anymore, obviously because of Charlottesville, but because we have a healthy free speech environment over here. And so we're more along the lines of online propaganda, spreading the word. Whereas Patriotic Alternative, the Britnats, they don't have as much protection for speech as we do. So like they're sort of forced to, show good optics and go out there and spread the word the way they do. So that just proves the point of the entire optics debate. And it's not even a question anymore. And as far as like the solidarity thing goes, you know, with Ricky Vaughn, I sent a entropy in back during the Charlottesville trial a couple years ago. I think it was 2021. And I asked you about burying the hatchet, because there was a lot of guys, you know, in that court case that I didn't really care for. I don't like them. And, you know, I sent the entropy in, which the audience can do if they feel so obliged. But I asked, you know, like, bury the hatchet and cover down on these guys, because, you know, I was feeling sort of torn. Like, I don't like these guys. I don't really care about them or what happens to them. But the higher principle is we can't like just turn away from these people, you know, because they represent something, regardless of who they are, regardless of the individuals involved. They represent something that affects the entire movement. It affects the entire political landscape. So all these people dunking on Ricky Vaughn, they've sort of lost the plot. You know, they need to do a little bit of reflection.
Yeah, I think we need to step back from this and recognize that it's a show trial. As one of the people in the chat put it, Dino, it's a freaking show trial. And we shouldn't be cheering the victimization of this guy. Now, Ricky Vaughn was doxxed by a Wignat. He was doxxed by Paul Neelan, which is a shame. And again, the doxing of this guy, I thought was just absolutely appalling. And Paul Neelan was already dead to me at that point, but he became unresurrectable at that point. I think that we should have an absolute social death sentence, a total shunning of anybody who doxes people. That's just, you can't welcome people like that into a movement, because if there are people in the movement who dox people vindictively, good people who have things to lose will never get involved. They will look around and they'll think, ah, I face enough risks from the establishment, from the Antifa, from the scum in the streets. I am not going to also put myself at risk from the likes of people like Paul Neelan or Daniel Freeberg at Arctos, who doxed a couple of people in his career out of vindictiveness too. You simply won't get good people involved if you have doxers and you coddle these people in your movement. It's just totally despicable, and it cannot be tolerated, therefore. And we will never grow as a serious movement if we don't have solidarity with the victims of doxing and absolute zero tolerance for doxers.
Well, when somebody is doxed, the doxer is basically making a tacit alliance with Antifa and journalists. Absolutely. Not as much difference. And two, it's also depriving us of a huge weapon, which is anonymity. And yes, I would prefer that more people be face off, mask off in real life. But here's the thing. We need to keep people anonymous because of the concept of the forest rebel or Waldganger. So not everyone can be in Patriot Front. Not everyone can be, you know, a public figure. But when we have, you know, guerrilla activism, like whether it's REM or all these active clubs doing stickers or whatever, or people doing guerrilla activism online, the fact that you don't know who these people are drives the system crazy, because they don't know who it is. And Ernest Younger talks about this in the Forest Passage, where someone writing it in for no on a wall is terrifying because you don't know who did it. At least when you have like 2% who voted no, you know who they are, or you can figure it out. Or it's just like, okay, there's only 2%. Well, how many other people agree with this guy who wrote the end? That's right. One we see, and it's this huge iceberg. And because they can't see it, they can't control it. And these people are control freaks. So as soon as they deplatform us, there was a huge deplatforming, I remember, after Charlottesville. They immediately started freaking out about how they couldn't monitor us. So it's like, well, yes, you stupid idiot. That's what happens. And so, we are taking away our ability to basically wage a nonviolent partisan war against the enemy. Consider our public figures, our public marchers be like our army, and then partisans to be running around, everyone who's anonymous, a partisan. And in Carl Schmitt's theory of the partisan, he observed that the Red Army would always pop up after the partisans had made it safe, more or less. So even though I despise the Red Army, of course, because they're Judeo-Bolsheviks, it's a good point.
Yeah. I made the point in an article at Countercurrents on secret agents, basically. And I also have a piece on doxing, which I've reprinted a number of times because it keeps coming up. It keeps being relevant. It's absolutely despicable. Richard Spencer doxed one of his donors to NPI, for instance, because he got mad at this guy and said, this guy donated money to the NPI. The guy denied it. Whether the guy did it or not, it was clearly an attempt to harm this person because it was an attempt to get the system to harm this person. Yeah, it's an alliance with journalists and Antifa, as if there is any real functional difference between the two, or the deep state for that matter. It's an attempt to use our enemies and our enemies' power over us to settle petty personal grudges. But you strengthen the system that way, and you weaken the movement that way. It's incredibly foolish and short-sighted behavior, and that's why it simply can't be tolerated. So the Ricky Vaughn thing is definitely a huge source of controversy, but I do think this is a case where we do need to set aside that kind of stuff. And we don't have to endorse the things that we disagree about him, you know, with him about or anything like that. We just have to say that, look, this guy isn't being attacked for any of the bad things he said that hurt my feelings or this person's feelings. He's being attacked for the good things that he represents. And these good things that he represents and is being jailed for are the things that we've all practiced and we depend upon. So, yeah, I think that's enough about that. Are there some other questions here? Let me just go to entropy and check in. Okay, we've got a couple questions here at Entropy. Dr. X Cathedral, by the way, it is great to see you back commenting at Countercurrents. I was a little worried about you. I hadn't seen you for a while. He sends in $10. How to respond to anti-white rhetoric that we are imperialist, genocidal, colonizing invaders of North America and therefore lack all moral standing in the face of BIPOCs and must kowtow, reparate, and self-erase? Okay, it's basically the argument that the Great Replacement is just desserts because we colonized this continent and therefore it's only just that the continent be taken away from us by another wave of colonists. Well, there are a lot of points here to make. I wrote an article called The Autochthony Argument about this issue in part. But let's just pause for a second and reflect on the fact that suddenly diversity is no longer a strength here, it's a punishment. I thought these people were coming here to enrich us and make us happier, and you're saying that they're here as our just desserts for our sins? Which message is it? Is immigration enriching us all, or is it our just desserts for the evil that we've done? These people have to get their message straight. And if they want to run with the argument that it's our just desserts for all the evils that we've done, then we can at least add the idea that it's a strength and enrichment to the dustbin, which is a good step forward, right? We need to point out that these people are treating it as punishment. Now, the other thing I want to say about all this stuff about colonialism, et cetera, is this. I totally sympathize with people who want to decolonize their countries. I totally sympathize with Africans and Middle Easterners and Far Easterners, non-whites, and whites around the world who want to decolonize their countries. I sympathize with that struggle completely because I'm an ethno-nationalist. I believe that we should have a world where every distinct people with a will to autonomy can have a homeland of their own, a sovereign homeland of their own. That's the view that I think is right. So, for instance, I look upon the Ukrainians and their desire to decolonize Ukraine of Russian influence, and I think, yeah, I totally understand that. I totally understand the Irish desire to decolonize their society. Their language is a lot further gone. It's almost extinct, whereas Ukrainian isn't an almost extinct language. But I understand their desire to regain what they lost, okay? And that's just a universal moral principle. However, I think there's a more important principle here than the idea that the people who first occupied a piece of land are its rightful owners. Because if you look at history, land ownership is constantly changing. Peoples are migrating around, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That just happens. So what particular land distribution is the right one? What one do we have to go back to? Do we have to go back to the 8th century or the 10th century or the 1st century BC? Which is the right land distribution for the different peoples of the world? At a certain point, that just becomes ridiculous, impossible question to solve. And so the more important question is not, do these people have the right to the homeland that they grew up, that they sprung up from the earth in? That might be long lost. You know, there are these people in Europe called the Hungarians. They arrived in Europe in the Dark Ages. They claim that they have a homeland, which is in the center of Europe. It's called Hungary. Do we want to say, no, you don't have a right to that homeland? Your homeland is somewhere in Asia. That's insanity to do something like that. So my view is that it's more important to make sure that everybody has a sovereign homeland wherever they happen to be, rather than litigate and relitigate all these wars and migrations and injustices that have took place throughout history. Even though I totally understand the desire of people to do that. I totally get that. At a certain point, you've got to say enough is enough. And we simply have to say, look, there is an American people now. 400 years ago, there wasn't an American people, but there's an American people now. And if history had gone in a very different way, there wouldn't be an American people. And they would have no claim to have a homeland. But we are a people, and we do have a homeland, and we have a claim to it. Now, there were other peoples here, and we can make spaces for them, and we have made accommodations for the Aboriginals to the extent that that's possible. We should set aside a homeland for Black slaves, and we should probably just repatriate other groups that have less of a claim to a territory in North America and be done with it. I want that to happen. That's the ethno-nationalist solution. So that's what I say, you know. We have every moral standing to resist displacement in our homeland because it's the only homeland that we've got, and every people deserves a homeland of their own. And these people who are coming here, they have homelands that they can go back to. So anyway, that's my basic answer to that. So I want to go to Thomas first and then Gadius. Do you have any thoughts on this? How do you respond to this anti-white rhetoric that we're imperialist, genocidal invaders, and now we're getting our just desserts? That's the basic question.
Yes, because everyone who's a genocidal imperialist person is simply competent at history. If you look when we arrived here in North America, one of my favorite articles is by Ann Coulter. It's called, it's something along the lines of Have a Historically Accurate Thanksgiving. And it's run every year. There's a little variation title. I can't find it a good one off the top right now, but long story short, when the pilgrims arrived here, they saved the Wampa. I'm going to call them the W Indians. It's like the Wampanoag tribe, because the Iroquois Confederacy was waging a genocidal white race war against them, where they would kill and enslave everybody, men, women, children, and torture them. And because of the evil white pilgrims, the Wampanoag tribe, or the W people, were saved. And, you know, this whole notion that, you know, the Indians were living in harmony with nature and painting all the colors of the wind, that is patently false. They were scalping all the colors of the wind. The Mississippi Mound Builder Civilization actually destroyed the environment and petered out. That's from Jared Diamond, who I don't agree with a lot of his ideas, but I think that one is correct. The Chacoa Mississippi Mound Builder Civilization destroyed the environment. And a lot of these like Indians, they waged brutal war against themselves and against white people. And American Croghan, he did a really good stream a while back. I forget when, but where he talked about Wounded Knee in regards to this one anti-white video game called Bioshock. And Wounded Knee, it was really a terrorist attack against white people. The Indians were shooting out of teepees that had women and children in them, like terrorists using like human shields. And to really illustrate this point, there's this Indian woman who was taking pot shots at the white troops as she was fleeing for the camp. And they didn't shoot at her because she was a really bad shot and they didn't want to kill a woman. So that whole narrative is historically false about us being really nasty people. We were probably the most civil people to arrive on this continent in a long, long time. And to, like you said, Greg, like everyone at some point, how far do we go back? Like Mongolia would basically have to enslave itself to make the, like, as reparations for everything that they did. And it's just ridiculous. It only goes against white people. And two, I also want to like add in some Aristotelian golden mean. The whole thing of like, oh, they were imperialists. It's all that is slave morality. That's venerating the weak. It's wallowing in victimhood. And I completely disagree with it and refute it. However, I also disagree with the other side, where they take it to the other extreme of master race and morality and supremacy and kill them all. That's also stupid. That's also too much of a good thing. In between, in the middle, following the Aristotelian golden mean, you can just say like, hey, things were rougher in the past. Everybody did it. We've changed now. You know, wars have become much more destructive, and let the borders stay how they stay, and don't make this all into a moral issue when really it's only about power. Always has been, always will be.
I approach it from, first, whoever's bringing it to you, you got to take into consideration. So if it's a non-white, then you just simply question their moral bona fides. If they talk about, oh, this is payback, then it's like, okay, so it was bad back then, but it's good now, like you were saying, Greg. And then you just call them out on it. You say, okay, so you really don't actually have any morals. You're just anti-white. This is just a power game for you. And if it's a white person, then you just point out, well, you're concerned about the morality of the situation. And that's understandable, because that's a very white thing of you to do. You like, you're concerned about morality. You're concerned about fairness. Problem is, all these people you want to import, they're not really concerned about that. All they care about is power, and you're just going to get steamrolled later on. And of course, if they happen to be a fellow white, then you just go, well, okay, well, diversity just kind of works out in your favor, because, I mean, it's easier to subvert a society. So I don't even entertain the argument at all. I sort of just straight up question their motives to begin with, you know? So when it comes to non-whites, it's like, it's a non-starter. It's like, you really don't care about morality. All you care about is power. So get lost.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, two wrongs don't make a right. If they really think that it was wrong for us to lose, to take this land away from the Indians, then they have to think it's wrong for them to take this land away from us. That really does seem to be a logical position. And therefore, you know, they have to bring in this idea that we are in just uniquely deserving of punishment. Right? Because wouldn't they then say that, well, we took this land from the gringos and it's perfectly okay for the Chinese to sweep in here and take it away from us? They would definitely have to hold that view, unless they just want to come out and just explicitly say that, no, white people are just uniquely bad. We're uniquely bad and deserve anything that we can, you know, they can get away with against us. And if they want to hold that view, well, that's just fine. We don't have to take them seriously anymore, and we can just point this out and hope that other people don't take them seriously. This is ostensibly a moral argument that they're putting forward, but it rapidly dissolves into something deeply evil and immoral and just sort of vicious special pleading, gaslighting, manipulation, and brutality. It's disgusting. Alain de Benoist said this really well. He said, all these arguments about reparations for historical injustices basically consist of people who have suffered no wrong demanding free stuff from people who have done them no wrong based on something that happened in the past. And once we see through that and just point this out and just show that this is a grift, this is a game, and it's a game that we can't win, and therefore we should not play, it should come to an end at that point. But white people love to give crazy people and evil people the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they're right. Let's try and look at it from their point of view. And we have to do it. Yeah, get it out of your system. But we've got to bring our people around to recognizing that this is just evil. This is an evil grift, and it's an attempt to exploit us through our virtues. And one of our virtues is trying to see things through other people's eyes, trying to do the right thing and so forth. This is just a counterfeit of that to exploit and destroy us. ABC has written in with 10 US dollars. Trump warned of death and destruction if he is charged in the bimbo hush money case. How likely is this to happen? What's the minimum threshold percentage of people willing to act in this manner in order to have a street revolution? 3%, 5%, 10%, 50%? That's a good question. How many people do you need to have an effective revolution? My feeling is that if large crowds of Trumpians start gathering in the streets, they are going to be very, very rapidly put down by the military and the National Guard. If the post-January 6th hysteria is any indication of that. Now, maybe that's all out the window, as we've seen transsexuals and their friends can now have transurrections, I should say, at various state capitals. And it's all okay. It's all okay. The entire system of the government and industry is not going to be trying to dox and destroy these people's lives. So maybe it's okay. But my feeling is that it's probably not okay for Trump supporters. So I don't think we're going to be allowed to discover what the tipping point is, because I think they'll try and nip that in the bud very quickly. Gadius, what are your thoughts?
I think it's gonna have to be sort of a balancing act, because obviously they can't go full throttle. I like when Trump says stuff like that. I love when he takes a bundle of dynamite and throws it out into the discourse. I wish he'd do it on Twitter instead of Truth Social, because the only people that actually follow him on Truth Social, besides like the diehards that are on the platform, is like the media. They're like, oh, did you see what Trump said on Truth Social? And everyone else is like, no, not really. Nobody's on Truth Social. But I like when he does stuff like that. And I think him framing it that way, like death and destruction, you know, there are still people out there. There's like the media. He basically broke a lot of people and terrified a lot of people that are, you know, like regime shills. So that is sort of scary to them. Like, they take it seriously. Like, obviously we don't take what he says literally, but they do, because they're dumb and he broke something in them. So I think it's a good thing when he does that. I don't really see any like riots or anything, anybody taken to the streets over this. I wish Trump would handle this a little bit differently, a little bit more smoothly. We need a little bit of that 2016 mojo back for our guy. But theme of this stream is caps locked. I wish he would quit doing that. It just makes him look like he's desperate and flailing and sort of like, you know, screaming into the void. Old man yells at cloud.
Yeah.
But I wish he'd be a little bit more shitposty about it, a little more, you know, ironic or whatever. And that would probably make his enemies even more scared if he looked like he was a little bit more under control. But who knows at this point? I don't really see any like January 6th type things going down for the foreseeable future, unless something really crazy happens. God forbid.
Yeah, nothing will come of this, because, you know, all the people who would be willing to do that, a lot of them were already rolled up from January 6th. And everybody else learned a lesson that Trump is basically a me nationalist. It's all about him. And therefore, you know, we've seen numerous patriots thrown under the bus and abandoned while he went to go golf at Mar-a-Lago. And while I'm pro-Trump because he's useful to us, like, let's not forget, this is a full, wholly self-interested man. He did not, you know, if people fall for this a second time, they're just stupid. The only people who would fall for it a second time are utterly deranged Q people who think, like, I don't know, Biden is actually Trump.
Next week.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's like, and they're crazy. And all those people did get rolled up. And no, I know you did say, Greg, you know, they send the police or military to deal with it. They actually wouldn't. I think they would let them do their thing because it's mostly harmless. Say if they did do some stuff, cause some damage, it'd be pretty tame. But then they'd unleash the NKVD of the FBI upon them and start, you know, charge them with fake crimes. Oh, it's a hate crime. Oh, this. Oh, it's a misdemeanor. We're still going to raid you with 40 goons at your house, traumatize your family. And they'd do it that way because they actually wouldn't want to have the police and military screwing off against patriots in this climate. That would be an inch too far. I think we're at a place where nobody wants to be the person to start a, you know, what I would call civil unrest, very politely, but they sure want to get close to it. So they'll try to like go the other person into making the first move and therefore making themselves look bad. And they'll come right up to the line, but no one's going to actually cross the line. They probably, and too, if people do go out in real life to protest this, be careful, man, because there'll be Asian provocateurs. There'll be feds everywhere trying to cause like January 6th stuff. And the thing here is that, no, we shouldn't, ideally, if I was Trump, I wouldn't allow that to, you know, prevent me from doing a call to action. But the call to action would be very definite and it would be peaceful and lawful. So instead of like promising death and destruction like a Wignat, Trump should be promising a white strike. Why don't we just strike? Why don't we just not do anything? We will stop going to work. This country runs upon the blood, sweat, and tears of Republicans, mostly white. We can simply not go to work. The trains will not run. Literally, they will not run. The airplanes will not run. And the military, I don't, you know, that's a huge risk because you can be like court-martialed and all that, thrown in the brig. But, you know, what the military just said, like, I'm not doing this anymore. I don't think that's feasible because of the vaccine, how the vaccine mandate, you know, triage all the cool people. But there's so many things in this country that depend upon white men. There's that goofy movie, Day Without a Mexican. What about Day Without a Republican or Day Without a White Man? The country couldn't function. And we could bring this country to our knees simply by saying, we will not be your slaves anymore. You have to respect us. And therefore, by doing nothing, we would do a lot more than simply, you know, flying about wildly in death and destruction or whatever Trump envisions with that reckless statement.
That's excellent. I really agree with that. I do like the idea of the general strike. The Atlas needs to shrug. And Atlas Shrugged, I think, cries out for a racialist interpretation. So yeah, I think that would be absolutely wonderful. And it would be peaceful and nonviolent, but at the same time, it would send a message that we're really tired of being blamed for everything while holding up the whole country and carrying it on our shoulders. I think that that would be a tremendous, tremendous message. So yeah, that's a great idea. I wish Trump listened to sensible people like us rather than bean counters and basically spin doctors and whatever idiots he listens to. But you know, hell, Kanye West and Fuentes got to sit down to dinner with Trump. That still kind of amazes me.
He listens to the last person he talked to. That's literally who he listens to.
Like, yeah,
if you're the last person to talk to him, he'll repeat everything you say.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what happened with Iran. Like, Tucker had to literally jump on a plane and go prevent him from starting war with Iran. Like, this is a child who needs a supervisor.
Yeah. So I'll take my stand, has written in with $20. Thank you very much. It's good to see you again. The regional differences in the USA are still most noticeable among whites, and the US is too large for a workable republic. If there were a racial separation in the US, wouldn't we still need a more robust federalism or secession for genuine populism? You know, I'm going to be a little contrarian about this. I know what you're getting at. You're from the South. I'll take my stand, Dixieland, etc. I know what you're getting at. And there are differences between the North and the South, but a lot of people in the South really misunderstand these differences. And you don't have to travel very much outside the South before you realize, well, wait a second here. Actually, the stuff that you call Southern is, maybe the accents are different, but the attitudes are very, very common all across the United States. You've got, you know, Southerners, but out West, you've got cowboys, and cowboys and Southerners basically have the same values. Let's just put it that way. cowboys, lumberjacks, southerners, they all have the same values. Maine fishermen, they have the same values. It's really ultimately a distinction. And this is the more operative, polarizing distinction. It's the distinction between white people who have their feet on the ground. They don't necessarily have to work with their hands. You know, they can work with their heads too, but they have their feet on the ground. They live in reality versus white people whose heads are somewhere else in the clouds. Let's say it nicely. Their heads are in their clouds. A large number of non-whites that they use as pawns and tokens in their struggles with the bad white people that they're trying to differentiate themselves from. That is the main polarization in America. And that is not a regional polarization between North and South or East and West. If it's regional, it's really only maybe urban-rural or even urban-suburban and urban-rural. So the other thing is about the South is full of Yankees now. I used to live in the South, and I'm from the West. I can't be called a Yankee, I suppose. My family, they were Southerners at one time, and then they moved West. And others came directly from the British Isles long after the war between the states. So I'm a Westerner. But I've lived in the South in large chunks of my life, and half my friends in the South aren't Southerners. So it's not that much of a regional distinction anymore. So I don't really think that when things break up in America, the national divorce happens, that there's going to be a Dixie. I think that's an old struggle. And I think that's a lost cause. I think there will be a South, but the good things about the South are basically, again, with slight differences of cuisine and accent, are the good things you find in the other parts of the country, even rural New England. And you probably have more in common with sensible people in rural New England than you do with city-fied Southerners in Atlanta or Charlotte. These are just my thoughts. So I don't know if we had like a racial partitioning of the U.S., if we would need more of a federalism and secession. I don't know about that. I just don't know, because I don't think the South really is all that different. The good things about the South, I don't think, are really all that different from the good things about the other parts of white America. So anyway, that's pretty heretical maybe in these contexts, but those are my thoughts. I'm going to go to Gadius first. What do you think about this? Do you think we're going to need something more than just a white ethnostate, that we might have to have more than one state? Might be, you know, because there are too many regional or cultural differences between white people in the United States?
Not anymore. Not at this point in time, because like you said, like it's gotten to, you know, basically urban, suburban, rural divide now. It's like, I'm a hillbilly from Appalachia in the north, you know, from Ohio. And the thing is, though, like I made a vow to like not learn any new lingo that these kids are throwing out there nowadays. But like I know all, like everybody knows like what everyone else is talking about now because of like the media, like social media and the homogenization of culture, because we're so interconnected. So like you said, I don't think there's going to be very much differentiation as far as like culture is concerned. I mean, there's still going to be accents and maybe, you know, people that like to go outdoors more than other people or whatever, but it's still going to come down to like basically just political sensibilities. I think it's going to be like, you know, the right wing type people that, like living in the city, will still have more in common with, like, you know, a right winger from the backwoods. So maybe farther on down the road, if we do get like a secession, separation, ethnostate, national divorce, whatever, maybe further on down the road, we'll be able to like heal our damaged cultures and like, you know, return with the V to our cultural roots or whatever. But as far as right now is concerned, I don't think so. There's just too much interconnectivity. Like we've got like more present concerns too, as far as I'm concerned.
Thomas?
Yeah. So my take on that is that just like they say about communism, real federalism hasn't been tried yet. As soon as very shortly after our founding fathers set up the federal system, which is supposed to empower states, not cuck them, they got cucked because the wealthy industrialists started encroaching upon the rural states. I think that if we had a national divorce, we would have I'm quoting from Warhammer 40K here, a place where united we fall, divided we stand. Everybody would be so fed up with the tyranny of the current federal government that real federalism would be practiced, where states can do their own thing. For example, right now, from the very beginning, admittedly, the founding fathers didn't want to have the states making compacts with each other, because they were like, well, then if they start doing that with simply economic, well, that could quickly become militarily. Then you have secession. They didn't want that. I think we should frankly welcome that. And here's the thing. I'm an archaeo-futurist, and usually that's more of a technological thing, but I think a type of neo-feudalism could be done. I'm not advocating for some like monarchy thing or some like LARPy crap like that, like the Tradcast are into. I think really having it where there's different levels, and it's very organic. For example, the Holy Roman Empire was a total mess, and it was beautiful because while there was conflict, it was managed. And so I think having states, leagues of states, like maybe a, quote, League of the South, or municipalities, cities, counties doing all this stuff and agreeing and disagreeing on their own terms would be beautiful. There'd be conflict, but it'd be managed conflict. There'd be mutual respect. And, you know, once we do our national divorce, we'd all be willing to allow ourselves basically bloom in our separate gardens. I'm from the suburban West Coast. I wouldn't want to impose my values on the South. The South wouldn't want to impose themselves upon me. The South has always been a lot more, you know, very strongly religious. We're a little bit more relaxed out here. We would get along because it'd be like, okay, just stay out of each other's hair. People can move to where they want to move. Counties can do their thing. And yeah, I think regionalism should be embraced, and regionalism will not be contrary to having a national divorce. I think there needs to be a Western, I'm very proud of the Western third of America. We're very outdoorsy. We have a beautiful country here. It's different. We have similar values, but there's a different flavor to just how we act. And that's the thing. We would not want to oppress each other. We simply don't want to be oppressed. So I think there could be a Dixie Confederacy in a national divorce that's part of a larger whole. Kind of like how the Greeks, you have like Aeolian Greeks, Ionian Greeks, Doric Greeks. But once the Persians show up, they usually all allied against the enemy. It's totally fine. We have a patchwork of laws here. We already do. The laws already are, there's already 50 different flavors of crazy with how the laws go. All you really need is a national currency and cooperate militarily, and the rest take care of itself.
Yeah, I think that is well said. I want to look at a couple more questions here. Folks, if you would like to send questions, comments, and super chats, we very much appreciate it. So please do that. You can do it at StreamYard. I'm sorry, we're at StreamYard. You can do it at Entropy. You can do it through Odyssey. And you can also just send me an email at editor@counter-currents.com. I have a few sort of quick lifestyle type questions, listicle type questions here from Eric. Eric, thank you for sending these in. So let's just run through some of these and see if some big philosophical questions come along too. These are fun as well. When you were a kid, what are some of your favorite board games? They can be games you still play today. Okay. The only board game that I liked when I was a kid was Monopoly. And I don't still play it today, but I did like it. Also created a board game. And unfortunately, my mother was doing some kind of house cleaning thing and didn't realize what it was. And I think she threw it away or threw away the box that it was hidden in or something. And I was never able to recreate it. But the thing that I loved about it was that basically, and this was, I think I was like 12 or 13. I think I was 12 years old. It was before I was in the seventh grade. when I did this, it was a class project that we worked on. And I really love this. And this is sort of my nascent right-wing hard determinist sort of views. I'm not a hard determinist, but I think determinism plays a huge role. Because basically, based on the first roll of the dice, your fate was your fate was already predetermined. The outcome was predetermined. The first time you rolled the dice, if you were in place 1 through 6, there were just a whole different set of possible outcomes, and you could never get outside those tracks. And I played it a number of times with people, and they loved the game, but could see it sort of sinking in, you know, that this was not fair. This did not seem fair. And for the life of me, I could not reproduce it after a couple of years had gone by and it had been thrown away. So yeah, that sort of lost to time, I'm afraid. Gadius, did you ever play board games, and do you play them now? Do you play them with your kids?
Sorry. Sorry is the ultimate board game, because you get to really put the familial bonds to the test, because you get to screw each other over at will. And it really gets interesting. I highly recommend, especially, you know, if you're a family guy or whatever, you play Sorry. It's a fun time, and it's gets pretty interesting. You know, sometimes you get hurt feelings, and you'll be in the doghouse for a couple of days afterwards, but it's a good time. I really enjoy it.
What about you, Thomas?
Definitely Monopoly, although that game could get pretty vicious when we played it. And then it's not technically a board game, but Magic the Gathering, which I played for years and years and only quit recently because I moved from where I was playing, and then they also went woke. But it's kind of like a board game, and there's a lot of there's a lot of internal politics between your friends that comes out.
Okay. Eric asks, what are some of your guilty pleasure movies? I think we'll just leave out anything that's worse than R-rated here and just say things that are kind of silly. Well, there's a list of silly movies that I do like to watch, and I call them comfort films. Sometimes when it's a rainy day, or I'm just really tired, or I've been sick or something, and you know, I just pop these things in as for a reset, and they're all kind of zany films. And so a few zany films that I like, I love Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I think that's just never ceases to amuse me. I love The Fifth Element. I love this ridiculous film called Hudson Hawk that stars Bruce Willis as well. So those are a few sort of zany films that I enjoy. I guess I would call them guilty pleasures because they're not serious movies. They're very, very goofy movies, but they still have a lot of merit to them. Another one is the Flash Gordon movie from the late 70s with the soundtrack by Queen. That cracks me up. And also in the same vein is Barbarella from the late 60s. That is just a totally goofy guilty pleasure that I will sometimes dip into, and it's a good mental reset. Gadius, any guilty pleasure movies?
Yeah, stupid, but the dumbest movies you can think of. It's sort of becoming like a family tradition to watch really, really horribly made low budget movies because they're unintentionally hilarious. So I'm thinking of stuff like Samurai Cop or Troll 2. It's not even about trolls, they're goblins. And Shark Attack 3 is pretty good because it's like got that cheesy 90s Baywatch feel to it, and the acting's just atrocious. And then there's this it's sort of a meme movie now because it's sort of exploded online. It's called Fateful Findings. It's by this horrible director, writer, producer, Neil Breen.
James O'Meara introduced me to Neil Breen. James O'Meara is a bad movie connoisseur. And that is truly amazing stuff. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a delight. It's a delight to watch, but it's also like, man, it can really be taxing, but it's just so fun. It's fun to watch with, you know, like family members or whatever, just as a gag. So just look up a list of like the worst movies ever made. And I try to crank one out every once in a while.
Thomas?
So I will never allow the liberals to ruin Star Wars for me. Those will always be beautiful movies. And then Spaceballs. Because remember, merchandising, that's where the real money for the movie's made.
Yeah.
Spaceballs, toilet paper. Spaceballs, the drinkable sippy cup.
Yeah. Okay, I have another question here from Eric. Have you ever met or known someone you would describe as a piece of shit? Yes, but I don't think I can just say yes for all of us, but we don't have to name names here. So I'm just going to move on to your other question. Your other question is, who are some of your favorite writers living or dead? They don't have to be white European writers. Okay, I'll name a few, and that'll give these guys some time to think of a few others. Favorite writers? Well, I'm going to name some big philosophical heavyweights because these are the people who really influenced me. Plato, Aristotle, who else? Immanuel Kant, Martin Heidegger, a bit of Friedrich Nietzsche. I'm going to put Nietzsche in a secondary list. Giambattista Vico. These are people who've very much influenced my outlook on life. William James, the American pragmatist, very much influenced my outlook on life. Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I really respect and love Machiavelli. Now, I've been taking up cudgels against what you can call Machiavellianism as a popular idea. And it's certainly an idea that can be based on Machiavelli. There are certain things that I disagree about, but in Machiavelli, sort of his methodological assumptions. But as a defender of the republican form of government, as a critic of monarchy and tyranny, I think he's an absolutely wonderful thinker. And one of my projects in our little sphere of the internet and our sphere of the intellectual world is to bring back classical republicanism. Too many of our people on the right, the nationalist populist right, are thinking in terms of the big man, the great leader, the prince. They have a monarchical or dictatorial fixation. And Machiavelli has an appreciation for those types in certain circumstances, but it's also very, very clear that he thinks that that's not the best form of government. And that republics, where you have a large number of people participating in government, a form of popular government, is a better form of society. And he likes it because there's more liberty and more justice. And it's very interesting to read this writer from the beginning of the 16th century talking about the importance of liberty and free republics and things like that. It's something that makes me resonate more with the American founders. The American founders are more influenced by people like Machiavelli and Montesquieu, and Aristotle, were Republican thinkers, than they were by classical liberals like John Locke. And we have been fed this false Lockean understanding of America's founding, and this fundamentally false classical liberal understanding of what it is to be on the right. That's just part of the refashioning of America into deracinated universalist kind of society. And we've forgotten the influence of the classical republican tradition, which is not classically liberal. And so I really have to say, I absolutely love him. He's one of the great political writers as well. So anyway, those are a few writers that I highly recommend. And I'm going to be talking more about these people in the future. I published a book on Heidegger. I'm bringing out a book on The Trial of Socrates in a month or so. I've got tons of stuff on classical and modern philosophy, and I'm going to be writing some fairly substantial stuff on Machiavelli. So, Gadius, who are some of your favorite writers?
Well, I don't really have a big list. They're mostly just people that basically write for Countercurrent. So Uncle Jimbo is probably up there number one, you know, because he's all about, you know, just the facts. He's about what's true and false. That's a funny thing, because like whenever something happens, like his latest article about the tranny shooting up the school down there in Tennessee, it's like, I know I'm going to get like facts. This is where I go for facts, is Jim Goode, because he's like meticulous about it. So he's up there. And then, you know, Rich Howe, you, Greg, also Greg Hood. Those are the people that I read the most. And I'd say for like authors, well, Pat Buchanan too. He just recently retired. I always enjoyed his stuff. And, but as far as like authors goes, I'd say like David McCullough for like popular authors or whatever. Like his books are always pretty good. I can highly recommend his Wright Brothers book too. It's pretty enjoyable read. So it's mostly just contemporary people, you know, right?
Yeah. And all that. You know, in the realm of literature, I actually more enjoy H.P. Lovecraft and Frank Herbert and Tolkien, and also Mishima. I read them more than I go back to the classic literature as well. So yeah, those are some people as well.
I forgot to mention Mencken too. I got on a real Mencken kick there for a while, and he's just absolutely enjoyable to read. I highly recommend people go look up his stuff too.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that Jim Goode is the Mencken of our age. He's the greatest American journalist since Mencken. So, Thomas, favorite authors?
Yeah, so for politics, I'd probably say it's Ernest Younger and Oswald Spengler. Like, for when I read Spengler originally and went beyond the means, it was like earth-shattering. I was like, well, this version of history makes sense. Then also Julius Evola, and I just want to like put this out there. I'm not one of these like new memers. I was reading Julius Evola in 2010, and it's kind of quietly keeping it to myself. I remember when Julius Evola felt like a magical secret, and it's nice to see his ideas become more widespread. But I also feel like maybe they're diluted or not taken seriously. So it's kind of like a bittersweet win-lose thing. And then also, yeah, like Tolkien, Lovecraft, and Robert E. Howard, who wrote the Conan stories. For me, they're not overtly political, but they have an aesthetic. And that aesthetic does have political ramifications, where it goes from that aesthetic to what would a policy be like. And so I think they're good like moral compasses, really. And people might be questioning why the author of Conan, Robert E. Howard, would be that person. Actually, the original Conan was very intelligent. He's very cultured. Robert E. Howard is very cultured, and there is a heroic vitalism to it woven throughout. So it's actually very deep. It's not just like Arnold Schwarzenegger making grunty noises.
Yeah.
And then too, I'm currently reading Savitri Devi, and I'm probably going to do some articles reflecting upon her. And then I haven't read him yet, but Francis Parker Yawkey has kind of caught my attention.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he'll be added to that list soon.
That's great. I got a question here from Splash with a $10 donation. Thank you very much. Do you think white America still has open wounds from the Civil War? Well, yeah, I would say so. They're more open than ever. They're open in two ways. One, it's Jews and Marxists and people like that who are trying to scratch these wounds open by attacking the monuments that were put up basically as a symbol of reconciliation. All these Confederate monuments were there. And also naming military bases after Confederate figures. All of these were symbols of reconciliation, burying the hatchet, getting on after the war. And I think it's not understood what a lot of these monuments and names signified. But it's the left that is really reopening these wounds by weaponizing these Black grievances, basically. And there are people in the South who are white Southerners, of course, who still feel that this is a very real divide and a very real injustice. And you can't read the history of it without being sympathetic to the South in many ways. Ultimately, though, I think Lincoln's Negro policy was correct. I don't think that he should have launched this horribly destructive war to force the Union to stay together. I think he should have let the South go. But I think he had a better Negro policy than whatever would have emerged from the South. So those are my thoughts on it. Gadius, do you think there are still open wounds from the Civil War?
Yeah, on the renaming the military bases, it doesn't make me seethe. It sort of just makes me laugh. It's like, yeah, where's most of your warm bodies come from? United States military mostly comes from white Southerners, white Appalachians, Midwesterners, whatever. And you're basically just spitting in their face, and you want to put out these ads like appealing to our patriotism. Please join up. We're missing our recruitment goals. Oh, and by the way, we're going to spit in your face and rename Fort Hood. It's like, yeah, go F yourself, I'll keep it PG, but yeah, the only wounds that are open are the ones that keep being ripped open by our enemies. So yeah.
Yeah. I think the recruitment stuff is topic for another show. We did have it on the list of things that we could talk about. So let's just see how that continues. I do think it's very, very encouraging, though, that white men are opting out of the system. And they should, because the system is stacked against them and wants to destroy them. Let trannies and illegal aliens fight. It's one of the signs of a declining empire to have foreigners staff your military, because your own people won't do it, or you don't trust your own people to carry arms. That's just a long-standing fact of history. It's a sign of decline when you cannot get your own people to bear arms for the country. So it's encouraging to us. Thomas, what are your thoughts? Are there still open wounds for the Civil War?
Yes, I think they're, like you said, they're ripped open, but I think they never really healed. I think maybe they tricked the South into thinking they were healed, but people still look down upon the South. I think the South, even when a lot of whites wanted to move on and be reconciliatory, the South still got the short stick, it seemed like. They still weren't given, they weren't developed well. They didn't get investment. They were kind of, disparaged. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, those silly Southerners. Well, you're not investing in them. And, what became a self-fulfilling prophecy? I think there's still elitist attitudes, particularly on the Eastern North seaboard, against them. And I think them coming clean, this attack on white people and Southerners, is good, because they're being honest. This is one of the few times the government has actually been honest about its intentions, how it feels about people. And they're collapsing, and it's going to get worse and worse. Because, great fact, recently, Pentagon says only half of its F-35 jet fleet is mission ready. Their goal was 65%. And I'll tell you this, from personal experience, a lot of people who work on the flight line are white men. A lot of them are from the South. And I know some people say, oh, if all the white conservative men leave the military, it'll be taken over by Vanquishas, and they'll unleash their hordes of foreign mercenaries against us. Well, the military is fully dependent upon air power and all their fancy gadgets and stuff like tanks, very high-speed intel. You need white men for that. The planes literally will not fly without white men. I would not feel safe. If all the ground crews were black, I would not have felt safe. And yeah, so this is beautiful. We will starve the beast, and I'm actually going to write an article about the Achilles option and archaeofuturism, where we need to be like Achilles. Achilles stayed out of the Trojan War because he was dissed by Agamemnon. And Agamemnon took his girlfriend, and people, I hear this other argument of, training this, training that. There's more training outside, because guess what? There's more veterans who are high speed, low drag outside than people who stayed in. A lot of people who stayed in weren't that high speed. You can learn more from doing, paintball or airsoft than going to basic training. Basic training is obedience training, but they make you a dog. They don't want to sharpen you into a killer that much. They want you to be obedient. All the practical stuff can be dealt with outside. And a lot of it, people also focus too much on the gun stuff. The reason why they cut to Boy Scouts is because they're teaching all the other skills that you need to make a good infantryman.
Yeah, Gadius, what are your thoughts?
I was just saying, he's talking about the people that stay in and the people that get out. Yeah, that's pretty. There's some good people that stay in, but a lot of people that stay in are just careerists. They want that 20 years and then get the paycheck, and they stay in for the paycheck because the civilian world, their prospects there probably wouldn't be as good as the guaranteed paycheck in the military. So yeah, I'm
also It's different now. It's like, it was one thing to stay in, you know, maybe 6 years ago, but now it's like, you got to take your vaccine. You got to, you know, be on the watch out against extremism. It's like, you got to serve a senile commander in chief. So it's a lot different. It was already, people stayed in general with lower quality back 6 years ago, but now I would have to imagine it's not, it's pretty bad.
Yeah. Go find a tranny.
Yeah. They can defend your system. It's their system now. So let them die for it. Right. So yeah, guys, we've been going on for 2 hours. I think this has been a great discussion. I really, really appreciate it. I want to thank you for coming on board. I want to thank the donors who sent Super Chat money. Very much appreciate it. I want to thank the moderators for helping out. We have such a good group of people here that the moderators don't have to do much moderating. They're just sort of putting links in the chat, which I think is fantastic, very useful work. So that, again, very much appreciated. And I want to thank all you wonderful people out there in the dark who are listening in. Next week, I will be back. I haven't decided who is going to be on the panel, but we have so many great people to choose from. So it might be Gadius and Thomas again. We might have Pox Populi back, but no matter what comes, we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. So folks, first of all, Thomas, how do people follow your work?
Right now it's just on Countercurrents with my tag, but I might be making a Telegram channel in the future. I'll keep you guys posted.
Great. And Gadius, you are one of my favorite boosters. You're around the Countercurrents platforms, you know, on Telegram and just the webzine and everywhere. So that's where people can look out for you too. Are you you've got your own channel on Telegram though? Can you please encourage people to follow that?
Yeah, it's called Building a Third Force, but I always like to shill other people's stuff. And White Art Collective's Hyreth, in-house musician Hyreth, just came out with an album today or yesterday. It's called Woven, and it's available for digital download and CD pre-orders. So she's our gal, and she's got a baby on the way too, and she's actually a pretty good musician too. So I'd encourage people to check that out.
Well, that's great. And your Telegram at this moment has 644 subscribers. Folks, I'd like to see that go over 700 very soon. So if you aren't subscribing to Gadius's Telegram channel, go there and follow Building a Third Force, because he has great takes on things. I'm constantly stealing ideas from Gadius, so this is why he's one of the guys on the show. Anyway, guys, we will be back in another week. Thank you again, and take care.
Take it easy. See you.
Have a great day.